As you've already heard many times today, our story today is David and Goliath. And we've been going through Old Testament and New Testament and looking at people that had personal encounters with God and had their life forever changed by that. And the story of David and Goliath is certainly one that, as a young boy, captured my heart. And I know a lot of my friends' hearts as well, because it involved so many of the things that we have an appetite for as kids, involving adventure and bravery. I mean, think about it. It involves a giant, sticks and stones, and a slingshot. It involves battle or war, sibling rivalry, catching the attention of a king, getting to make the palace, the king's palace, your home after this event. And after all of the other things, at the very end of it, the hero is a boy. And kids, it reminds me of one of my favorite movies growing up. Perhaps you've never seen it before. It's a Disney movie. I looked, it was made way back in 1963 in the Dark Ages, a year before I was born. So that lets you know how ancient I am, called The Sword and the Stone. And The Sword and the Stone is a really cool movie because it's about this orphan boy called Arthur, who ends up taking the sword out of this legendary sword that's stuck in a stone. No one else can remove it. And he's able to remove it from the stone, and he ends up becoming the next king of England. So another story, beloved story that involves a kid as a hero. And I got a joke for you kids as we begin today. It's a groaner, but it's a kid joke. But who is the greatest babysitter that's mentioned in the Bible? Yeah. I got a hint for you. We're talking about David today, so it's David. And David is the best babysitter that's mentioned in the Bible because it says that he rocked Goliath to a deep sleep. So there you go. We need the drummer over here. Adults, I got one for you. There was a certain archaeologist who was digging in the Negev Desert in Israel, and he came upon a sarcophagus containing a mummy. And after examining it, he called the curator of a prestigious natural history museum. And he said, "I've just discovered the 3,000-year-old mummy of a man who died of heart failure." The excited archaeologist exclaimed. The curator replied, "Bring him in and we'll check it out." A week later, the amazed curator called the archaeologist and he said, "You were right about the mummy's age and cause of death. How in the world did you know?" The archaeologist replied, "Easy. There was a piece of paper in his hand that read 10,000 shekels on Goliath." Guy who lost a bet. All right. Let's get into our passage. We're going to be looking at 1 Samuel chapter 17 today. And I want to read the story in its entirety for you because there's so much good stuff in here that we're going to pull from. And I'll do a few comments along the way, but we'll dive into it. 1 Samuel chapter 17 in the Old Testament. This is what we read. The Philistines now mustered their army for battle and camped between Succoth in Judah and Azekah at Ephes-Damim. Saul countered by gathering his Israelite troops near the Valley of Elah. And 8 years ago, I got to go to Israel for the first time and actually stand in this very valley. There's two hills on either side, on the east and the west, that face each other, undoubtedly where the Philistines stood on the west and the Israelites on the east from Judah. And there's a stream that runs in between, and we actually got to go in this rock bed and pick out stones as David would have. Awesome thing. I'll never forget that. Verse 3, so the Philistines and Israelites faced each other on opposite hills with the valley between them. Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall, 9 feet, 9 inches to be exact. The Guinness Book of World Records says that the tallest man who ever lived was 8 feet, 11 inches. So Goliath beats that by quite a bit. He wore a bronze helmet and a bronze coat of mail that weighed 125 pounds. So kids, just the coat of armor that he wore alone weighed 125 pounds. And he also had bronze leg armor, and he carried a bronze javelin on his shoulder. The shaft of his spear was as heavy and thick as a weaver's beam, tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. His armor bearer walked ahead of him carrying a shield. And Goliath stood and shouted a taunt across to the Israelites. "Why are you all coming out to fight?" he called. "I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. Choose one man to come down here and fight me." This is an example in ancient times of how they would do representative war. And it didn't happen a lot, but they would do this because it reduced the massive bloodshed of everybody fighting and killing each other. They would choose a representative, a warrior from each team or each country or each side who would determine the outcome. Goliath goes on in verse 9. He said, "If he kills me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel today. Send me a man who will fight me." When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. Verse 12. Now David was the son of a man named Jesse, an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. Jesse was an old man at the time, and he had 8 sons. Jesse's 3 oldest sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shimeah, had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. And David was the youngest son. David's 3 older brothers stayed with Saul's army, but David went back and forth so he could help his father with the sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, every morning and every evening, the Philistine champion strutted in front of the Israelite army. One day, Jesse said to David, "Take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers." Due to the lengthy standoff, for 40 days they're facing off, they began to run short on supplies of food. And so the families of the soldiers would send reinforcements, and that's exactly what David's doing. Verse 18, he said, "Give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain and see how your brothers are getting along and bring back a report on how they're doing." Verse 19, David's brothers were with Saul and the Israelite army at the Valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with the gifts, as Jesse had directed him. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelite army was leaving for the battlefield with shouts and battle cries. Soon the Israelite and Philistine forces stood facing each other, army against army. David left his things with the keeper of supplies and hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Then David heard him shout his usual taunt to the army of Israel. As soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run away in fright. I kind of get this picture that Brittany was talking about, how every day, 40 days, both morning and evening, the Israelites are psyching themselves up to go out. They got the battle cry and they get out there. Then they look at this terrifying giant and they go running away in fear. Think how that must have reinforced the confidence and the strength of the Philistines as every day this was repeated and just kept going on in front of them. Crazy and pretty pathetic. Verse 25, "Have you seen the giant?" the men asked. "He comes out each day to defy Israel. The king has offered a huge reward to anyone who kills him. He will give that man one of his daughters for a wife, and the man's entire family will be exempted from paying taxes." David asked the soldier standing nearby, "What will a man get for killing this Philistine and ending his defiance of Israel? Who is this pagan Philistine anyway, that he is allowed to defy the armies of the living God?" And these men gave David the same reply. They said, "Yes, that is the reward for killing him." But when David's oldest brother Eliab heard David talking to them, he was angry. "What are you doing around here anyway?" he demanded. "What about those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know about your pride and deceit. You just want to see the battle." "What have I done now?" David replied. "I was only asking a question." He walked over to some others and asked them the same thing and received the same answer. Then David's question was reported to the king Saul, and the king sent for him. Verse 32. "Don't worry about this Philistine," David told Saul. "I'll go fight him." "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There is no way you can fight this Philistine and possibly win. You're only a boy, and he's been a man of war since his youth." But David persisted. I've been taking care of my father's sheep and goats, he said. And when the lion or a bear came to steal a lamb from the flock, I went after it with a club and rescued the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turned on me, I would catch it by the jaw and grab the fur under its chin and club it to death. I've done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine. Saul finally consented. All right, go ahead, he said, and may the Lord be with you. Stop there for a moment. Ironically, it's this young shepherd boy, David, who has ultimate faith in Yahweh God, rather than the king, the leader of the Israelites. And we see just Saul's confidence and his strength is waning as he concedes to this young shepherd boy. Verse 38, then Saul gave David his own armor, a bronze helmet and a coat of mail. David put it on, strapped the sword over it, and took a step or two to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things before. I can't go in these, he protested to Saul. I'm not used to them. So David took them off again, and he picked up 5 stones from a stream and put them into his shepherd's bag. Then armed only with a shepherd's staff and sling, he started across the valley to fight the Philistine. Goliath walked out toward David with his shield bearer ahead of him. Isn't that ironic that a Goliath is armed with all this stuff and he's got somebody in front of him, a shield bearer, and David's going out all by himself. And in those days, a shield bearer had a shield that was like 6 feet tall. It was so big the guy could stand behind the whole thing. And it had leather on the front, so if flaming arrows came, they would be extinguished before they did any damage. So these guys are fortified. They're set. Verse 42, he was sneering in contempt at this ruddy-faced boy. Am I a dog, he roared at David, that you come at me with a stick? And he cursed David by the armies of his gods. Notice that he's not just defying and taunting David, but he's blaspheming the God of Israel. He's using taunts and horrible things about God as he's trying to poke fun at him. Am I a dog, he roared. And he cursed David by the names of his gods. Come over here and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. David replied to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your head. And then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. David is already anticipating that when he beats Goliath, the Philistines are not just going to surrender. It's going to be an all-out massacre because they're not expecting to lose. That's the last thing that entered their mind. So he knows it's going to be this bloodshed. Well, verse 47, everyone assembled together. And verse 48, Goliath moved closer to attack. David quickly ran out to meet him. In contrast to verse 24, where the Israelites are seeing this guy every day and running away, David is running quickly toward the giant. Verse 49, reaching into his shepherd's bag and taking out a stone, he hurled it with his sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead, just beneath his helmet, where there was one spot where he was vulnerable. And the stone sank in. This shows the accuracy that he had. The stone sank in, and Goliath stumbled and fell face first to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with only a sling and a stone, for he had no sword. Then David ran over and pulled Goliath's sword from its sheath, and David used it to kill him by cutting off his head. Most scholars think that the stone only stunned Goliath, and David was running up there while he was unconscious to take advantage of grabbing his sword and finishing off the deal. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they turned and ran away. Then the men of Israel and Judah gave a great shout of triumph and rushed after the Philistines, chasing them as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. The bodies of the dead and the wounded Philistines were strewn all the way on the road from Shearim as far as Gath and Ekron, roughly about 10 miles. It's a lot of territory to cover. Then the Israelite army returned and plundered the deserted Philistine camp. David took the Philistines' head to Jerusalem, and he stored Goliath's armor in his own tent. As Saul watched David go out to fight, the Philistine, he asked Abner, the commander of his army, "Whose son is this young man?" "I don't really know," Abner declared. "We'll find out who he is," the king told him. And as soon as David returned from killing Goliath, Abner brought him to Saul with the Philistine's head still in his hand. "Tell me about your father, young man," he said. David replied, "His name is Jesse, and we live in Bethlehem." A lot to read there, but there's a lot going on that I wanted you to know about. And I wanted just a few introductory things. First of all, I want you to consider that this one moment forever changed David's life. Many people had no idea who he was. He was just this young kid, just a shepherd boy. Even Saul didn't remember him, which is troubling because in the last chapter, David goes to play his harp for Saul and sing for him when Saul would be tormented by evil spirits. David would calm him and bring him peace. And even Saul doesn't seem to recognize him. Some people say, well, he knew who he was. He just didn't know who his dad was. Because when he asked David, he doesn't say, "What's your name?" He says, "Who's your dad?" And David doesn't say, "My name is David." But he replies, my dad's name is Jesse and we're from Bethlehem. So that's one of the thoughts that people have to try and reconcile these two things. The other thought is that David was really young when he went to go play his harp for King Saul. And a few years had transpired, and now he's kind of a teenager, and he's bulked out. He's a lot bigger. He's kind of a warrior, you know, raising these sheep and defending them against the lions and the bears. And so maybe that's why Saul didn't recognize him before. And we get the feeling that when David would go and play his harp for Saul, it would be intermittent. He would go from time to time, but he didn't live there. Like after this battle, when Saul said, "I want you to permanently come and live with me." And maybe that's why he asked, "Who's your dad?" Because he was like, "I need permission for you to transfer where you live to my palace." I also want you to notice the sibling rivalry that's going on here. Notice that David's main interaction is with his oldest brother, Eliab. And Eliab is like a lot of older brothers. I'm the oldest son in my family. I got two younger brothers, and I was always, giving them a hard time. And notice in verse 28, this seems to sum up their relationship, how Eliab demeans and minimizes David's work. Where are those few sheep that you're supposed to be taking care of? Did you just abandon them? Did you just run off? I know your evil motives. You're not here to give us supplies and reinforcements. You want to be where the action is. You want to be in the middle of the battle. You're just here to make a scene. David is the youngest of eight boys, and you get this feeling that he's always having to prove himself. He's the scrappy survivor fighter young kid who's always being kind of marginalized and having to stand up for himself and get attention. He's used to competing with people that are older than him and way above his pay grade, and this is no different. And again, on this day when Israel comes to face off against the Philistines, David's life is forever changed. It's forever redefined. From this point on, no one will ever again forget his name. In fact, the stories about David would circulate to the point that they would be the beginning of King Saul's demise, his undoing. Just as Samuel anointed Saul in chapter 10, and just as that was followed by Saul's defeat of the Ammonites in chapter 11, so also we see Samuel anointing David in chapter 16. And then it's followed here by David's defeat of Goliath and the Philistines in chapter 17. And each of these victories for Saul and for David represented the courage and the determination and the military expertise of the newly appointed leader of God. There's three quick things that I want to share with you today. Three things I want you to notice. And the first thing involves horizontal versus vertical comparisons. Horizontal versus vertical comparisons. Everybody in the story is looking around them. They're looking horizontally. How big the army is. How big the giant is. How crazy the odds are. How horrible the circumstances are. And they're letting fear dictate what they do. David is the only one who's looking vertically. He's seeing everything in terms of God. And who these people represent, the false gods that they believe in, as opposed to the true and living God of Israel. David's looking vertically while everyone else is looking horizontally. Verse 24 says, as soon as the Israelite army saw Goliath, they began to run away in fright. Have you seen this giant? They said. And after all, he was 9 feet, 9 inches tall. As we said, a coat of armor, 125 pounds. And get this, his spear, which was probably about 6 feet long, big javelin spear, had a shaft at the end that weighed 15 pounds. To put that in perspective, that's like if you had a 6 foot pole and you stuck it through a watermelon and then tried to hold it in your hand. Imagine holding a pole with a 15 pound weight at the end. I have this hydro flask that I like to use on hikes and long trips, and I fill it with ice water and tons of ice. And a lot of times as I'm driving, I'm trying to drink that thing with one hand. So I'm holding it by the mouth of the hydro flask, 64 ounces. And it's all I can do to just hold it with my wrist and drink without spilling it all over me because of the balance of it. Imagine holding a pole with a 15-pound weight out there, a watermelon, if you will. And how strong his arms and his wrists must have been. I mean, this guy was fearsome. And notice the contrast between the attitudes of David and the men of Israel. The men of Israel call Goliath this man. David calls him this uncircumcised Philistine. They say that Goliath has come out to defy Israel. But David sees him defying the armies of the living God. It's about God, not about the Israelites. They refer to Goliath's potential victor as the man who kills him. David refers to this man as the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel. In short, all the men of Israel are looking horizontally. They're making horizontal comparisons. David is the only one who sees this uncircumcised Philistine as defying the living God. He's seeing things vertically. And even Saul himself introduces another horizontal comparison in verse 33. He says, there's no way that you can fight this Philistine and possibly win. You're only a boy. And he's been a man of war since his youth. Remember that scene in The Sound of Music where the Captain Von Trapp, he's kind of belittling his daughter's boyfriend who's joined the Nazis. And he says, you're only a boy. And that was it. The guy just lost it after that. And he's blowing the whistle for all the rest of the authorities to come. But here, Goliath is taunting him, and Saul is reinforcing it. You're only a boy. He's been a man of war since his youth. Well, David doesn't worry that he's not wearing the proper war attire. He goes with what he knows. He goes what he's tested. He goes with what he's tested in the past. And I'd be the first to admit, if that were me, I would want to be suited up with the best and the finest equipment that everybody else was wearing. I would just throw the past and what I'd used in the past to the wind, you know? I think I would be the first to want to be suited up properly. And a lot of people think that Saul wants to clothe David with the traditional armor of war because it was generally believed that to wear the clothing of another was to be imbued with the essence of that person and to share in their very being. And a lot of people see Saul's actions as him trying to claim some credit for the victory by David at least using his armor. If he doesn't have the courage and the bravery to go out there himself, at least his armor can be involved and he can get some, you know, recognition from that. But David denies Saul's potential moment of glory and he turns it down and he says, no, I'm not going to use it. Some of you might be asking, what's the big deal between horizontal and vertical comparisons? And as I was thinking about that this week, here's the big deal about them. Whatever we look to, whether it's a thing or a person, that thing or that person has the power to shape our identity. Whatever we focus on, whatever we obsess about, becomes powerful enough to shape our identity. And not only that, but what we look to or who we look at really says a lot about the validation that we're seeking. We in essence, ascribe power to the very things that we look to and want recognition from. We unconsciously ascribe power to whatever captures our heart and our mind and our attention. And I love what Brittany shared a few weeks ago in her weekly video. You not only get an awesome worship leader, but you get this mini theologian who's got these great insights every other week that she's just putting out to us. It's like mini sermons. And she talked about the story of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and how when they went to Babylon, they were renamed. And part of the tactic of that was to reshape their identities so they would no longer see themselves as Hebrews serving the true God, but they would take on the false gods of Babylon. And that's exactly what's happening in our story. That's exactly what Goliath does in his daily speech to the Israelites. Notice in verse 8, he doesn't say, "You're the people of God." He says, "You're the servants of Saul." Who wants to be Saul's servant? The guy's a coward. He's hardly a leader. He's abdicating for the shepherd boy to take his place. Servants of Saul, not of the Most High God. Mere soldiers rather than warriors of the Lord of Heaven's army. Big difference in how you look at it. And the truth is, all of Israel's army was looking superficially at the surface, comparing the external factors that loomed before their eyes, that overshadowed all of their rational thinking. But David looked beyond these superficials to what they represented. In verse 45, he says to Goliath, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of Heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." From David's perspective, Goliath served a dead god, Dagon. Remember back in 1 Samuel chapter 5, the Philistines had stole the Ark of the Covenant from Israel, and they set it up in their temple. And do you remember what happened? The very presence of God dwelling in the Ark caused all of the false idols in that temple to fall on their faces, and Dagon in particular, the god of battle, fell on his face and was decapitated. It's kind of a precursor to exactly what David would do to Goliath, cut him off at the head. But David's thinking, these guys serve false gods who have no power to deliver. I serve the one true God. And it's like that verse that Brittany shared from the Message version in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 that says, "For our tools of our trade aren't for marketing or manipulation, but they are for demolishing that entire massively corrupt culture. We use our powerful God tools for smashing warped philosophies, tearing down barriers erected against the truth of God, fitting every loose thought and emotion and impulse into the structure of life shaped by Christ." And I thought about that verse in terms of today. What are powerful God tools? Simply put, I think powerful God tools are weapons that we have tested. They're weapons that we've used before. They're weapons through which God has granted us victory in the past. And that leads to my next point. Not only do we see David coming out with courage to fight this giant and looking vertically rather than horizontally, but I believe he's applying what I like to call transferable wisdom. Transferable wisdom. Rarely in life do we get to go through the same circumstance or situation twice. Rarely are things exact. But David's like, you know, I've never fought in an actual war. I've never worn armor. But this is no different than the lion or the bear that God has allowed me to have victory over. And I'm going to apply my success and victory with that to this situation and believe that the God that was faithful back then, like the song we just sang, will be faithful now. This week I read an account of someone traveling through the Holy Land. And while driving through the countryside and small towns of Jordan, they said this. They said, "It's amazing how many residents spontaneously would wave at our tour bus. Some of those who waved at us were shepherd boys, usually alone and perhaps 12 to 14 years of age, standing near their flock of goats or sheep, often in utterly desolate terrain. Toward evening, we'd see a boy leading his flock back to a tent where his Bedouin family lived. What does such a boy do all day in a rocky wilderness, I wondered, except look for shade and keep the sheep in view? One such shepherd boy in the Bible named David, who grew up not far away, must have spent his time singing songs and throwing rocks. Day after day with the sheep, there would have been lots of time to make up songs, and there would certainly have been an endless supply of rocks. And I'm sure that there were times when he wondered if he was wasting his time. But amazingly, those two skills, honed by hours of solitary practice while watching sheep proved crucial in God's plans for him. His musical abilities were put to the service of a tormented king named Saul to calm him and bring him peace. And later, David's musical abilities had a more lasting effect as he penned the Psalms that we still sing and recite today. And rock throwing? That skill, of course, led to his miraculous victory over Goliath. The stone slinger emerged as a national hero. This guy says, as I traveled the rocky landscape of the Holy Land, I pondered the rocks. They're everywhere. Easy to complain about or overlook. Yet for David, they were the raw material that God mightily used. Transferable wisdom. Taking the objects and the situations of our past that God has used and using that for faith in the future. I love that song that we just sang. I'm holding on to faith because I know you'll make a way. I don't always understand. I don't always get to see, but I'm going to believe it. I'm going to believe it. You make mountains move. You make giants fall. You use songs of praise to shake prison walls. So I will speak to my fear and I will preach to my doubt that you were faithful then and you'll be faithful now. Folks, summing that up, I believe transferable wisdom involves trusting in God's past faithfulness as we obediently move forward in our present circumstance. Let me say that again. Transferable wisdom involves trusting in God's past faithfulness as we obediently move forward in our present circumstance. It's not going to be the same as what we've done before, but it's going to be similar. And we need to take what we've learned from the past and apply it to the present. Well, the last simple thing that I see in our passage is that David saw God as the deliverer. Not one point in this story did David put himself in the spotlight, which would have been so easy to do. He could have said, man, I'm the warrior, man. I killed the bear. I killed the lion. I'm going to kill this guy too. Me. No. God delivered me from the bear. God delivered me from the lion. And God will deliver me and all of you from this giant, from this uncircumcised Philistine. David continually saw God as a deliverer, as the answer. Never takes credit for himself. In verses 45 to 47, David's response to Goliath's taunts begins and ends with both the ineffectiveness and the irrelevance of sword and spears. When the God of Israel is involved in the battle, David fights Goliath in the name of the Lord. And he makes that very clear. It's not my slingshot. It's not javelins or spears or swords that's going to win the battle. The battle belongs to the Lord, and he will secure it for us. Goliath would be just like the lion and the bear. God had helped David routinely rescue sheep from wild animals, and God would deliver David from Goliath. One closing thought, and I'll pray. In David's eyes, it wasn't really about the giants that he faced, but it was about what they represented. And I believe that's a golden nugget for you and I. It's not about whatever giant you're facing right now in your life, in your situation, but it's probably about what that giant represents. Because rarely are things about the superficial or the external. They're almost always about something deeper. Think about whatever looms in your life right now, whatever intimidates you, whatever threatens you, whatever makes you insecure, whatever keeps you from boldly stepping out in faith. It's not just that thing, but it's perhaps what that thing represents. And I want to just close today by reminding us all that Jesus is the greatest giant killer that ever lived. He took down sin. He took down Satan himself. He destroyed the power of sin over our lives. And even though we still fall captive to sin occasionally, it has no power over our eternal destiny because Jesus offered us a way to eternal life through the cross. And if you're here today and you've never started a relationship with God through Jesus, I encourage you to do it. It's the simplest thing you'll ever do in your life. It takes no effort. It takes no work. It's just about accepting what Christ has already done in your behalf. And I'd love to talk to you about it afterward. But I'm going to pray as I invite the worship team back up right now and wrap this up for us.